you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, yeah.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. My guest this evening is Dr. E. Michael Jones. Dr. Jones, how are you doing?
Good. Good.
Thanks for coming on the show.
You're welcome.
Well, coming back on the show. Of course, you are a historian, prolific writer, and editor of Culture Wars magazine. Your books include The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit and Its Impact on World History, The Slaughter of Cities, and the most recent Barren Metal, A History of Capitalism as a Conflict Between Labor and Usury. Your Culture Wars can be purchased at culturewars.com, as well as those books. Tonight I wanted to discuss the articles that you wrote for the January and February issues of Culture Wars, Julius Nyerere and the Heart of Darkness, and Crisis in the Maryknoll Missionary Order. I'd also like to talk about the missionary work of the Jesuits in the New World that you write about in Barren Metal, and as well as the society's development model and how it contrasted with, so we say, the British East India approach and with the current usurious economic hitman model of the neoliberal Washington consensus. And also talk about the Jesuits and some of the, the slander and libel they've been subjected to over the past centuries and their suppression. So how do you want to get into all that? What's the best way to approach those articles and what you've written about, about Nyerere
it's become a little more relevant lately because Martin Scorsese did a film about the Jesuits in Japan. The film is called Silence, and it's about one of the Jesuits that goes native. So someone is sent there, and it talks about missionary activity. Okay. The classic missionary group was the Jesuits. They came into being at the time of the Reformation. They were basically formed to fight the Reformation. But what happened around the same time was the discovery of the New World. And so as a result, the Jesuits found themselves sailing to the Americas, also to the East Indies, both Indies. They were a Spanish order, and Spain and Portugal were two of the greatest colonial powers of the 16th century. And so they went along with the ships. And so I was fortunate enough to be in Goa 2 years ago and went to the tomb of St. Francis Xavier, who was the second, probably the second most famous Jesuit right after Ignatius Loyola. Francis Xavier had left Portugal. He sailed along the coast of Africa. There were little Portuguese trading posts along there, Angola, Mozambique. And then you head off across the Indian Ocean, you come to Goa. And Francis Xavier landed in Goa. And he's famous for Goa, but he only stayed there 9 months. He was really, for some reason, he must have given up on India. I think it was just too much. It's too big, too many, too old, too much, whatever it is. So he left after 9 months and went to Japan. And he was completely fascinated by Japan. Took with him a telescope and other similar things to cast off his worn out black wool Jesuit robes and put on the silk kimono of the bonze and talk to them in Japanese, tried to learn Japanese and tried to talk to them, had incredibly sophisticated discussions with them, and was working and actually did create colonies of Catholics in Japan. But again, he was just one very restless guy. And so he decided he had to go to China at this point because Japanese culture was a function of Chinese culture. At this point, you needed a visa to get into China. He didn't have a visa. And so he tried to have someone smuggle him in. He was waiting on an island for a ship. The guy he paid to take him to the mainland never showed up, and he died on that island. And his body was incorrupt. And his body is incorrupt to this day. So you can go there and you can see him. And all Indians come from all over India, both Hindus and Muslims, and come and they look and they're sitting there, standing there talking to each other about the body. It would be perfectly incorrupt if the Jesuits hadn't chopped off his arm and shipped it off to Rome so that they can have a relic there for the saint. So the body is drying out, but it's still incorrupt. So this is one of these miracles that you get from the martyrs of the Catholic Church. Scorsese's film is based on a book by a Japanese man by the name of Shosoku Endo, who was a Catholic. And being a Catholic in the 1960s, 50s, 60s in Japan was a kind of an anomaly because those colonies that the Francis Xavier formed, Catholic colonies, were persecuted, ruthlessly persecuted. And so Shosoku Endo wrote a book, a very kind of subtle and sophisticated book about what it's like to be a Japanese Catholic in the land that he felt was, he referred to as the swamp. Basically a pantheistic culture where everything just kind of, all distinctions just melted away and you just felt yourself sinking into oblivion. And the book was about, in many ways, what it means, missionary activity. What is missionary activity? And also, I think we're talking about, if you're talking about Endo, we're talking about the crisis in missionary activity that afflicted the Catholic Church in the 1960s. Endo, as I mentioned in my review, is almost an exact contemporary of Julius Nyerere. And Julius Nyerere, as we've said before, was the first president of Tanzania, a black guy, African, who had gone to England, had studied at Edinburgh University, and was kind of majored in the Scottish Enlightenment, came back to Africa and led the country to independence, and then led it for the first 20 years of its independence, 25 years of its independence. But we're talking about a crisis here, a crisis that was basically, I think, the result of racial consciousness. This is the what I tried to talk about in the beginning of the Nyerere book. I entered Africa when I went to Tanzania in September the way everybody had to enter Africa, which is from the east, because you can't get in from the west. The only way in from the west, there's impenetrable rainforest all along the west coast of Africa. There's a major river called the Congo, which you can sail up, but before you get very far into Africa, you find a stretch of 220 miles of cataracts and rapids that make it completely impassable. And so as a result, the Congo Basin was a world that time forgot until the late 19th century. Now, we're talking about 400 years after the Portuguese set up these colonies along the coast. For 400 years, no white man had penetrated into the Congo. And when I got to Tanzania, I landed at Dar es Salaam, and we headed west. And it's easy to go west from Dar es Salaam because it's basically savannah. You can just keep walking. And so the great English and American explorers all started at Bagamoyo, which is now a suburb of Dar es Salaam. But even there, Stanley, for example, the famous Henry Stanley, who's famous for saying, Dr. Livingston, I presume, set off with his expedition, brought a horse with him. Makes sense. You're going to ride through a savannah. Why not take a horse? Tsetse fly bit the horse on the first day. The horse died on the second day. So this is one of the reasons, even going in easy, it was not easy. So I made it to Lake Victoria, and we're sailing across Lake Victoria. We're going to this an island, Lukoba Island, in the middle of Lake Victoria, and I'm just taking in the scenery. And suddenly I get this whack on the back, and Father Robert, my guide, says, "Here at the tsetse fly. This is the thing that killed the horse, and it's right on my back, ready to bite me." So it's still there. It's like there are so many diseases there that it's easy to see why it remained impenetrable. And that's what it remained today. But so you had this confrontation between the white people and the black people for the first time. And Heart of Darkness is one of the most famous narratives, which is basically about Conrad sailing up the Congo after taking the train past the rapids, sailing up the Congo to find Kurtz. And this is a kind of standard story now. As I said, Endo's story is Heart of Darkness. The guy goes native. Apocalypse Now is Heart of Darkness. Heart of Darkness was the first Heart of Darkness. And it's like this confrontation between the white guy, the European, and this world that no one has ever seen before, and people that you can't talk to who are savages. And so what it is basically the Enlightenment running up against a brick wall. This is, Marlowe keeps saying, you know, I couldn't understand what they were saying. There's no logos here. You know, he's overwhelmed. And suddenly he realized the Enlightenment has met its match in the Congo. And it ends on a completely pessimistic note. And that was, in many ways, the situation at that point. And in many ways, Conrad set the tone for later missionary work or the missionary crisis of the 60s, because he kept wondering about whether there's some type of universal logos. And you would think that Catholic missionaries would be beyond this, but they were. That must have been the tsetse fly that bit them when they got over there or something like that. Because they had this crisis. Like, are we imposing our views on these black people? Are we white folk? It's like white guilt. The Catholics get afflicted with white guilt after they've done enormous amounts of work there. Why are they suddenly afflicted with this? I don't know.
But is it because it's in the era of decolonization? Just sort of in the civil rights era?
It's the civil rights era. It's exactly right. Yeah. The civil rights era and the era of decolonization and independence in Africa are both the same time. So you have all these black people. We have to be honest here. The Belgians were ruthless exploiters of black labor in the Congo.
Yes, you're right about King Leopold in the article, yes.
Right, yes, yes. So have you seen the latest Tarzan movie?
No, but I read your reference to it.
Yeah, well, yeah. I finally got to see it on an airplane. Flying back from Iran. I finally got to see the Tarzan movie, and it is the most outrageous piece of noble savage propaganda that you can imagine. And of course, who is going to be the villain here? Who is the villain?
Well, it'd have to be a white man.
Not just any white man. It's the Catholic Church.
Really? Well, that's interesting.
Yeah. So there's this guy, Lahm, who is the agent for the King Leopold's operation there. And he's always got a rosary in his hand. So there's a great scene where he's ready to shoot the guy. He's got a gun in, and then the rosary wrapped around the gun as he's shooting this innocent, kneeling native. And then at one point, it's even better. The rosary has this magical property of strangling Negroes. You know, it just grabs the guy around the throat and strangles him. It's like a magic rosary bead to show you that the Catholic Church is the villain, and all these people need is to be left alone, and they will all be happy, noble savages. That's the current take. It's an exaggerated take, but it's pretty much, I think, what was afflicting the Catholic Church when they had this failure of nerve in the 1960s. Some type of failure of nerve. They felt guilty. And in a sense, as I said, they should feel guilty in many ways because there was a ruthless exploitation of labor. But in the Congo, for example, if you were captured as slave labor for the rubber plantation and you didn't meet your rubber quota, they cut off your hand. Now, why they would do something this stupid, I fail to understand. But it was the Belgian missionaries, the Catholic missionaries, who blew the whistle on these guys. Gave the natives white shirts, and they put their stump up against the white shirt. And it caused huge amounts of outrage in Europe and in America about the Belgian exploitation of the Africans. And it led to Heart of Darkness was one of the narratives that was in many ways a protest against Belgian exploitation. But Conrad Schipp was Roi de Belge, the King of Belgium. So that's what he was doing there. But the guilt had a crippling effect, a devastating effect on development in Africa. If we take something closer to Tanzania, Tanzania was never a British colony. It was a German colony, and Germany lost it after World War I, and then it became a British protectorate. And the big difference between a protectorate and a colony was that Kenya, being a colony, the British settled ex-soldiers, veterans there, who took all the best land in the highlands, northwest of Nairobi, and turned them into plantations, coffee plantations, tea plantations, and were involved in, again, the ruthless exploitation of African labor. Flogging was common, and it got to be so intolerable that there was a rebellion. It was called the Mau Mau Rebellion. And it took place from about 1953 to 1957. When they finally cornered the last guy. But I think the tragedy here across the board, and I'm including Tanzania, but all of Africa, is the failure to teach people how to work. Or let's put it this way, work got a bad name, because work for the black man was basically as a slave of the white man, a wage slave of the white man, who would flog him if he didn't produce what he was supposed to produce. And so you had this sense of the missionaries, I think, sort of got lumped together, even though they weren't doing the same type of thing, with the white exploiters. And they started to have these doubts about what they were doing. And as a result, the only engine for economic development that ever worked in Africa stalled out and died. And I'm talking about the missionaries. And I'm talking in particular about the Maranol missionaries in Tanzania. I actually met with the Maronite missionary, Father Arthur Willie, who brought Julius Nyerere into the church. First one to meet him, worked with Nyerere to come up with a Zenaki dictionary and a Zenaki. Zenaki was his tribal language, Zenaki grammar. This man was an extraordinary type of guy. We're talking about right after World War II, all these young Americans who have all these skills. They have skills they don't even know they have, simply by the fact that they're Americans. You know how to fix a car simply because you're an American, all this type of stuff. And they brought all these skills over to Africa and they just started doing things. And suddenly they started building up these big parishes and so on and so forth. And building pumps, for example, getting water out of the ground, helping people with modern farming techniques, moving them basically from the Stone Age into the 20th century. Africa was a place that never discovered the wheel, never discovered writing. It was just a primitive place. There's no other way to it. And suddenly you have these guys who come from this completely sophisticated technological world with all these technological skills, and they just start doing things, building things, one thing after another. And the church grows and grows and grows, and everything's going fine. And then Vatican II comes along. And then we have this crisis, which is following just on the heels of independence in Tanzania. And so as a result, you have Nyerere, who's like 39 years old. He's the youngest president of any country in the world. Going to the United Nations, being, you know, just a famous guy now, shows up at Maronite headquarters in New York, Ossining, New York. The Maronites are the people that brought him into the Catholic Church, taught him what he knew, helped arrange, you know, stayed with him, worked with him for years. Now he's addressing the Maronite nuns, and he says to them, we don't need you anymore. We can do it on our own. We need you to come and support the revolution. The church has a duty to support revolutionary movements throughout the world. Well, this was like telling Indians to go out and have a drink. You know, I mean, the Maronites have become involved in revolutionary activities in Central America. Four of them had gone native in their way. They ran off into the jungles of Guatemala and joined a revolutionary movement. And now he's telling them that they should do this. And they should, if they come to Africa, they have to live with the people. And live with the people and work for Ujamaa socialism, which was his invention. Ujamaa means family. So it's African socialism. As one of my friends said, met a Polish priest over there. Polish priest said, there's only one thing worse than socialism, and that's African socialism. So the nuns now go back to Tanzania, and now they're living like the people. Well, guess what the people do? They spend 5 hours a day gathering sticks in basically a country that is being deforested because people burn sticks to heat their meals and make tea. And then they spend another 5 hours a day getting water from the local pond. And so they're wasting all their time when they should be helping these people. Obviously, bringing the catechism and teaching them the catechism is the first priority. But the Catholic Church has always said that corporal works of mercy are part of preaching the gospel. And the corporal work of mercy here is helping these people to get over the fact that you don't have to spend 5 hours a day gathering sticks. There's a better way to do this. Well, they didn't do it. And so as a result, development economics collapsed in Tanzania. And so I show up. It's a lot of water over the dam since I show up at the act that at one of these Ujamaa villages, which is the model socialist village that Nyerere created right after the Arusha Declaration of 1967. The model village, which was to bring all the people together so that they could have effective infrastructure. this was not only that, it was the model village that Father Willie had created himself. It was his parish. He created the parish there. The village is called Kamuga. It's on the other shore of the Mara River estuary. So we go by boat, drive there. It's 6 miles from one of the second greatest source of fresh water in the world. And everything is burnt to a crisp and dying because there's no water. And so they take me to where the water is. It's basically, during the rainy season, you would call it a pond. At this point, it's about one-tenth that size. It's a mud puddle with the water that's the consistency of coffee, full of bilharzia and other parasites. And the kids wade into it with 5-gallon jugs, and they fill it up with this filthy water, and they take it home. And this is the way you get water. And as we're walking to the pond, we see the pump. This is the pump that Father Willie helped build, installed it, helped them, get water out of the ground. And the pump is broken. And the pump has been broken for 30 years now. 30 years. Nobody knows how to fix the pump. And so everybody just sits there during the dry season and basically they do nothing because there's nothing to do because you can't do anything without water. So this is, in many ways, that's what the title of the book is. It's called The Pump at Kamuge, Julius Nyerere and the Collapse of Development Economics. And so basically it's analysis that is the focal point of this thing. And this whole story is, well, why is the pump still broken? And so I'm at Julius Nyerere's house. Suddenly this Land Cruiser with Tanzanian flags over the headlights pulls into, and it turns out it's the governor of the entire state, the Mara region. So I walk over to him and, we got to strike up a conversation, said I'd like to interview him. I say, the pump in Kamuge is broken. He looks at me like, how does this Mzungu know about the pump in Kamuge? And then he says to me, every pump is broken. So it's not just Kamuge. Every pump in Tanzania is broken. So that's the situation as it exists right now.
Now, you mentioned that of course, Tanzania receives billions of roughly about $6 billion a year in foreign aid.
Yes.
Of course, somehow it doesn't trickle down to get the pumps working.
Nope.
I imagine Tanzania is afflicted with all the problems, corruption, and
right.
That foreign aid is. Yeah.
First of all, socialism naturally breeds corruption. It's absolutely no way around it. There's always bribery associated with socialism and corruption. And so that was the first wave of corruption, the creation of the socialist, huge Soviet-style socialist cooperatives that were basically nothing but graft and a way to enrich the people who were running it. That was followed by the privatization here, which made it even worse. That's exactly what happened in Eastern Europe, socialism followed by privatization, which leads to massive poverty. But in Dar es Salaam, you see these mansions, like the biggest mansions I've ever seen, surrounded by 13-foot high wall with razor wire on the top. And then there's a mud hut 10 yards away. I've never seen the rich and the poor so close together. The irony is, they're all members of the same parish, which is where I was staying when I was in Dar es Salaam. So I said to the pastor, I said, do these people get together? can't you have like a coffee and donuts after mass and introduce these people to each other? Because they're all hiding behind these big walls, but they're all within the parish boundaries. So I never got an answer to that question. But basically that's what happened. All that aid stayed in Dar es Salaam and went into the pockets of the oligarchs. And overwhelming majority are still poor.
Yeah. And in that article about Julius Nyerere, you have a section where you have this discussion with his daughter regarding the World Bank and Bob McNamara and debt and how Tanzania was loaded down with debt, supposedly for development, but now it's opened the country up for this sort of neoliberal raping that we see all over the world.
Yeah, the crucial turning point came in 1981 at the World Bank when Robert McNamara retired, and he was replaced by Tom Clausen, who was a Friedmanite. The whole world converted to Austrian school economics, whatever you want to call it. Milton Friedman was not Austrian school, but Mount Pelerin, whatever you want to call it, this neoliberalism that the Reagan and Thatcher governments started spreading around the world. And basically that meant that you didn't need development economics. This is unnecessary because according to this neoliberal ideology, the market is perfect. The market is the perfect distributor, brings buyers and sellers together in a perfect way, and so you don't need development. Well, it was catastrophic for developing countries like Tanzania because that's what they say. They talk about market, free market, blah, blah, blah. But we all know, or we know, those of us who have read Barron Metal know that the real definition of capitalism is state-sponsored usury. And if you ever needed proof of that, just look what happened at the World Bank during this period of time. Because basically what happened is that the first world decided they had to bust up the third world, what was called the third world. And their moment of opportunity came in the 70s. I mean, just to give the scenario, Nixon closes the gold window. So now currencies fluctuate vis-a-vis the dollar, which means overnight you can lose all your money. Overnight, everything can become very expensive. And so the third world at that point was composed of Arab countries and African countries and Asian countries like Indonesia and India. And suddenly the oil producing countries of that group decided, well, we're going to raise our price. And then they had a boycott. And suddenly during the 70s, the price went through the roof of oil. And at this point, people like Henry Kissinger and Helmut Schmidt saw their moment of opportunity. And so they rushed into places like Saudi Arabia and immediately said, we'll give you, what are you going to do with all this money now? Put it in our bank and we'll give you 10% interest. And that's the way they divided. They broke up the third world because now you had oil producing countries that were rolling in money, who were committed to maintaining the United States as the hegemon for the entire world because that's where the money was sitting. And then on top of that, these crafty English salesmen decided, well, you got all this money. Why don't you buy a couple jets? You never know how many jets, Harrier, you know, fighters you need. And so there was this orgy of defense spending. I experienced it personally. I was in Berlin. I was a teacher in Germany at the time. I'm in Berlin. I think it's 1975, the year that Vietnam fell. It's like midnight. I'm at a pizzeria on the Kudamm, and there I meet a prince from Saudi Arabia who comes up and kisses me on both cheeks and then takes out his gold cigarette case and offers me a cigarette. And then during the course of our conversation, offers me a job in Saudi Arabia for four times what I'm earning in Germany, plus a free car, plus a camel, plus three more wives or whatever. It was a huge package deal. So why is he in Berlin? Well, he bought 10 Mercedes and he wanted to know what was holding up the delivery of the 10 Mercedes that he just bought. So this was kind of the orgy of spending that was going on at that time. But they broke up the third world, split it up between the people that had oil and the people that didn't. The people that didn't then, guess what? We're going to recycle this money. Because what do banks do? They lend out money. So banks had all this money from Saudi oil. So now they're going to lend it to countries like Tanzania. And this was the era of privatization. And they got, so it was like the 1-2 punch. First, socialism. It's like the left, that's socialism. And then they finish it off with the right, capitalism. And by the end, you're lying on the canvas looking up, seeing stars. Because the original socialism was so stupid, and so inefficient that it wrecked the economy. Okay, so Tanzanians are now starving to death by 1974. And then by 1981, they change it and they start lending the money, so they're hopelessly in debt. So the situation is terrible there, and I think you put add this layer upon layer upon layer, and you understand why the pump in Kamuge is still broken.
Yes. Yes. The 70s is very interesting because, yeah, you get the closing of the gold window, then you have the Yom Kippur War, which some people think was fomented by Kissinger as a pretext to cause the oil spike, which would throw the Third World into debt and give them the opportunity for this predatory lending that would open it up for raping eventually, because the collateral was the blood, sweat, and tears and resources of these nations. This is the economic hitman model that so many people talk right. about. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely.
Just one of those moments of serendipity that the global elite always have. They just seem to be boys. They're so lucky. it helps if you control the central banks, though, I guess, you know, if you control the military.
The leaders of the West met at Chateau Rambouillet in France. I was in Germany watching on television. There's Giscard d'Estaing and Helmut Schmidt. I forget who else was there. Henry Kissinger was there, and they created up basically the New World Order, which was new. They called it New Geographies of Production, which basically was the beginning of outsourcing and the creation of China as the manufacturing center of the world, which we are now. What the Trump election was the final, the masses suddenly recognized what happened in 1975. This is the beginning of the outsourcing, followed by the leverage buyouts of the 80s, which basically were there to destroy the manufacturing base of the United States. Chop them up, load them down with debt, let them go belly up, and tough luck, you don't have a job anymore. But I made off like a bandit because I work for Goldman Sachs and I'm a leverage buyout king. And I believe in the free market. And this is what Reagan and Thatcher enabled. And now we're finally seeing the protest of it, the protest against it, I'm sorry, with Trump.
That's right. Well, there's nothing really free market about, you know, overturning Mossadegh in Iran in 1953 or Arbenz in Guatemala in 54 or Chile. They're just opportunistic, and then they call themselves, you know, well, we're just smarter than everybody else. No, they just have their hands in the levers of power, or they have information that they can act upon before anyone else does, which is the game in finance,
What you saw during this period of time was the development of a new form of warfare, covert warfare.
Yes,
and
you
were right in saying that the first example of it was the coup d'etat to topple Mossadegh in Iran in 1953. That was the beginning of it. Arbenz was right after that, 54. And we've goes right up to the Donald Trump election, where we have our own color revolution now.
The purple revolution.
Purple, the color purple. Hillary shows up wearing a purple, a bill with a purple tie or something like that. This is a George Soros color revolution to topple Trump. We're right in the middle of a civil war. All these things, these covert warfare techniques get applied to the United States ultimately.
Well, yeah, you made that point in that talk you gave in February 2016 regarding Nayeri, and he said you said that these people in the Third World, whether it's Africa or Central America, they're all live under the empire of Washington, London, and New York. And the same thing about South Bend, Indiana, or Gary, Indiana, or Detroit, is they're suffering under these macro economic decisions that are taken upon these people in palaces. That's monetary debasement. You're talking about Kissinger and the creation of the petrodollar, the enthronement of the dollar as the world reserve currency. This facilitated the deindustrialization of the United States because it overvalued the dollar, and it's made imports cheap. At the same time, they're exploiting China, which had been torn apart for the better part of a century by the Western powers, creating cheap labor, and this is part of the trilateralist model,
Yes, cheap labor is the key to this whole thing.
And you can create cheap labor if you destabilize countries, right? Create an urban, throw them off their ancestral homelands, create an idle urban population, and then you build a factory. Look, and then it's all free market. It's anything but. anything but. Yeah. It's, you know, it's horrible.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Well, Indiana is a conquered province.
Yeah.
And we knew that when we tried to the governor, who is now the vice president of the United States, passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And the CEOs were outraged. And Brian, what's the guy's name? The Salesforce.
Whatever. Oh, I know you're talking. Yeah, yeah. He's a homosexual, like, from San Francisco, right?
He's like the superhero now on the cover of Forbes, because he throws his weight around and pushes around state legislators when they say they don't want to when the people of North Carolina decide that the men's room should be for men and the women's room should be for women. Brian Bennington. Anyway, the Salesforce CEO flies in and pushes him around and says, look, I'm the boss here. I'm a CEO. You people, what are you? Someone elected you. So what? Who cares? I'm the boss in North Carolina. The oligarchs. So it was like this absolute crude exercise of oligarchic power. And the people finally wised up and they voted in Trump.
Yeah. I think that whole bathroom thing was in North Carolina might have factored in the Trump winning that state, because Obama won it in 2008 and 2012.
Yeah. No, I think it did. Yeah. I think it did. Yeah. Because
nonsense.
Unlike Hoosiers, who were stupid, the people of North Carolina, the legislature said, asked the obvious question. Why is this guy from San Francisco telling us what laws we can pass here? Nobody elected him, and he's not even from our state. This was Mike Pence was too stupid to ask that question when he was on Meet the Press. He didn't know what to say.
But also, you had the Obama Department of Education trying to withdraw federal funds if they didn't implement these rules. That was sort of this weird interpretation of, was it Title X or something of the Civil Rights Act regarding education, make the public schools start to have transgendered bathrooms. Of course,
Yes.
It's just ridiculous. And, well, another example of the absurdity, at least I think what reveals sort of the globalist corporatist conspiracy behind all this perversion, just, you know, is the fact that the national, was it the NCAA and National Basketball Association are getting behind the transgendered people, as if, you know, that's something that the NBA or NFL or NCAA should be concerned with. But those things are all part of the corporatist regime, though, because it's all about social engineering.
It proves that sports are a form of political control.
Yes.
If you ever need further proof, other than like a football field size American flag being spread out at halftime, being paid for, one of the main income sources for the NFL, now the ticket sales are down, is the Army paying you to do this, you know, as propaganda? Or Colin Powell on an aircraft carrier somewhere in the Persian Gulf saying that the Super Bowl is what America is all about. Did you ever need any more proof that football is a form of control, that professional sports or all the college sports, they're all for political control?
There was an ad during the Super Bowl that showed some huge military base, I think, like in eastern Poland near the Russian border. And idea of the ad was that our troops are watching the Super Bowl, and they're the ones that make the Super Bowl possible by being stationed just outside near the Russian Polish border.
It makes you hope for a Russian invasion, doesn't it? So we don't have to put up with this crap anymore.
I mean, that's nonsense. Really? That's what they're fighting for, the Super Bowl? Okay, fine. That's why we have troops in Poland, of all places. You know?
I was going to say, I just saw a graphic of a map of Iran, and then it's surrounded by all these American military bases in both Afghanistan and Iraq. And the caption is, why did the Iranians put their country so close to our military bases?
That's right. Now, you mentioned your article that you wrote regarding the decision taken in 1979 about, I think it was Twilight of the Oligarchs. And we're talking about, of course, we've got into this discussion regarding, you know, the transgendered bathroom issue. But even you mentioned that article is the left had given up, you know, I guess advocacy for the poor for cult, right? For sexual liberation.
That's right. That's right. That's Michel Foucault's pact with the devil. Mm-hmm. That happened in 1975 in Death Valley. And that's his term. It's not my term. He said he made a pact with the devil. And the pact with the devil was basically the left saying to the oligarchs, if you give us sexual liberation, we won't criticize your economic system. That is the new left. That's exactly why we have a homosexual mayor. I was in Berlin in June. I gave a talk on this topic then, about how it happened in Germany, the collapse of the Bader Meinhof gang. And Berlin has had at that point a gay mayor. His name was Klaus Wowereit, and his slogan was, "Wir sind arm, aber sexy." We're poor, but we're sexy. This is the model for Berlin. Well, it's South Bend, too. We have a gay mayor, too. We're following in Berlin's footsteps. So what does that really mean? What does that really mean? It means, basically, don't ask for a raise, okay? And if you're feeling down because you're not earning enough money, go to the gay disco and forget about all your troubles. That's the system that is in force in the entire Western world, whether it's Berlin or whether it's South Bend, Indiana. That's the system. That is the purpose of gay liberation. And now, just yesterday, a friend sends me an article by a professor from Villanova saying, guess what? The CIA was reading Foucault. The CIA during the 80s is reading Foucault. And this is precisely when the mayor's father, Joe Buttigieg, the professor at Notre Dame who hasn't written anything, has an endowed chair. That's when Foucault became the operating system of Notre Dame University and every other university. It doesn't matter what university, they're all the same. That's all Foucault.
Yeah, and the reason why these particular individuals are promoted and why we even know who they are. I mean, why do we know Foucault? Why do we know Gloria Steinem? Why do we know, who's the beatnik poet?
Allen Ginsberg.
Allen Ginsberg. Why do we know who he is? Because they're all put out and promoted by the establishment, by Time Life, by CIA. I mean,
Gloria Steinem was a CIA agent.
Yeah. Hired by Cord Meyer.
Foucault was basically Berkeley was the one who mainstreamed Foucault, mm-hmm. and gave him the professorship there. But it was the CIA studying Foucault. So I mean, it's not the CIA telling Foucault. It was Foucault teaching the CIA.
Yeah. It's interesting, going even further back. Now, I guess there's no coincidence that it was Jeremy Bentham who penned two apologies for both usury and pederasty, right?
Yes. And so they go hand in hand, don't they?
Yes, they do.
Sodomites and usurers are in the same circle in hell. According to Dante, because the sodomite takes what is sterile, namely money, and makes it fruitful through usury. And the sodomite takes what is fertile, namely sex, and makes it sterile through homosexual activity. So that's why they're in the same circle in hell.
Now, of course, the big problem facing the world today is odious debt created out of thin air. Policies, economic decisions that are taken to force people into debt by constant debasement, and also through easy credit, and then narrowing of their I guess you could say their economic choices or their decisions. So, a good example of that would be, housing debt with the housing crisis, and also student debt.
Yeah.
And all this right. is an instrument of control, correct?
Yeah. It's the fundamental instrument of control. Mm-hmm. I mean, we go back to, if you read Baron Metal, the story of the 19th century in England was basically Jews taking over the country by lending money to aristocrats and then taking them over.
And Churchill's an example. Churchill's family is an example.
Churchill family is the prime example of what we're talking about here. There's a picture there's a book called Churchill and the Jews. I forget the guy's name who wrote it, but there's a picture on the cover of Winston's father sitting next to Natty Rothschild at Tring, which was their estate. There's never discussed in the book. Wait a minute. I read through the whole book. Why don't you talk about that picture? Because his father died £80,000 in debt to the Rothschilds. That's a lot of money. back then. And the Rothschilds forgave the debt, and the author says it shows you what decent people they were. Well, no, I have a different interpretation. My interpretation is they wanted to capture Winston. And if there's one problem that Winston Churchill had, it was staying out of debt. He was forever in debt, and there was always some Jew who would show up and bail him out. You know, Sir Harry Strakosch was the famous one in the 1930s when he was in over his head. Well, you get bailed out and then you owe them a favor. And that's precisely why Churchill and in general, the English aristocracy were pawns of the Jews. It's no coincidence that the Balfour Declaration was issued by an Englishman, that it was the English who basically supported the founding of the State of Israel, this philo-Semitism because of money lending was part of the English character at that point.
And I guess their influence with certain powerful Jews in the United States that had surrounded Woodrow Wilson, some say even had blackmailed him. But it's Bernard Baruch, Jacob Schiff.
Yeah, Benjamin Friedman makes that point.
Yeah. Now, all this is very upsetting, but in this article you allude to, and in Barren Metal you write a couple chapters regarding an alternative model, development model, if you will, that the Jesuits had done in the New World regarding their missionary work. And they decided in order to spread the gospel that they needed to meet with, come to these people in the New World, particularly in Paraguay, but also in Canada. Teach them the value of labor, how to organize labor, how to, I guess you could say, bring them the benefits of the gospel through then modern techniques of agriculture and development. And this is an alternative model where the people aren't exploited. They're actually given skills to increase their value of their labor and actually create viable markets for export so they can import and develop the economy. Now, I'll let you talk about this. This is the wonderful story you tell in Barren Metal about the Jesuits, but ultimately it might have led to their dissolution in the 18th century and their subsequent, a lot of the libel and slander that the Jesuits are subjected to.
One of the signs that the Jesuits were being effective is the number of enemies they created. Mm. And their enemy were in the 18th century were the Freemasons. And there was one Frenchman who was an agent, a Whig. Let's back up here. If you go back to my other magnum opus, The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit, I talk about how the Whigs took over the Masonic lodges in the early 18th century and made them basically the English equivalent of the CIA. It was basically covert warfare, spreading Masonic lodges throughout Europe. And the main target was France, and they succeeded. The Masonic lodges were basically the breeding ground out of which the French Revolution grew. And the main agent there was Voltaire. And Voltaire had come to England, and Pope he met with Alexander Pope, the famous poet, Catholic poet. And Pope knew there's something wrong here, and it turns out he was a spy and an agent of the Whigs. And when he got back to France, he was forever promoting English culture as superior to French culture. And his most famous work, Candide, is basically an attack on the Jesuits in Paraguay. There were all these slanders going around, and Voltaire retailed all of them, that there was gold there, that the Jesuits were stealing gold from the natives. None of it was true, but he had a bestseller because the French Enlightenment crowd controlled the book sales in that country. And so they made it a bestseller. And basically it was the slander against the Jesuits in Paraguay. And it prepared the way for the suppression of the Jesuits, which was one of the great tragedies in the history of the Catholic Church. I mean, why didn't they suppress them they should have suppressed them, like in the 1960s. That was a good time to suppress the Jesuits. But no, these guys are suppressed because they're doing their job. And one of the main places they did their job, extraordinary work, was in both North and South America. The story of the Jesuits had to write reports back every year, every month, about what they were doing. And these reports, especially the ones about the Jesuits in North America, became bestsellers in France. And it was precisely to attack these bestsellers that Voltaire wrote Candide. The slander was mostly against the Jesuits in Paraguay. The Jesuits in North America, in many ways, there was a difference. I mean, they achieved a much higher level of civilization, a much higher level of culture in Paraguay for some reason than they did in Quebec. Maybe it's the climate. I mean, Quebec is a hostile climate, and maybe that held them back there. But the Jesuits show up. If you want the story of the Jesuits, visual images of the story of the Jesuits showing up, the movie is The Mission with Robert De Niro and Jeremy Irons. Jeremy Irons is a Jesuit, climbs up the waterfall, pulls out his flute and starts playing his flute, and all the Guarani come up to him and look at him, and finally they break the flute. But anyway, this is the way he makes his entrance, because music is logos, and that's basically what missionaries do. Catholic missionaries bring logos to primitive peoples. I mean, there's no such thing as a people without logos, because there's no such thing as a people without language. You can't find people who don't have language. It's part of being a human being. But what the explorers realized, there were different levels of development all over the world, okay? And people lived in very primitive circumstances. And the Guarani in Paraguay were one of those groups. So what did the Jesuits do? The Jesuits show up. I mean, did you ever try to learn a language? You know, I have to go to Argentina. I'm trying to learn Spanish before I get to Argentina, so I can give my talk in Spanish every day. And it's just, you know, kind of wearying. Well, the Jesuits showed up and they walk into the woods, and no one has ever talked to these people before in a European language, just Guarani. And the Jesuits, what do? They sit down, they learn the thing. The Jesuits in North America, the Jesuit goes on the moose hunt, which means he has to live in a tent, a teepee with snow up to your waist, because that's the only way you can kill a moose. The Indians get on snowshoes and they stab the moose with spears because it can't get through the deep snow. And then they eat the whole damn moose right there. And so it's they have like a furnace going on where they're cooking the moose. Outside it's 20 below zero. Inside it's 120 degrees. The Jesuit has his face pressed down to the bottom of the tent trying to breathe some fresh air. This is the type of stuff they had to go through. The Jesuits said these savages, they spend their lives in smoke and eternity in flames. That's why they were there, to baptize them, to prevent them from going to hell. And the Guarani, so they go into into Paraguay. They learn Guarani. They write a dictionary in Guarani. They write the Guarani grammar, and as a result, one of the official languages, the official language of Paraguay, is Guarani. That's thanks to the Jesuits, because these were extraordinary men, and they did extraordinary things. And one of the most extraordinary things they ever did was the Jesuit reductions in Paraguay, where after a generation, you've got Guarani who couldn't, you know, who were savages and loincloths with poisoned darts, making violins and playing violins, creating yerba mate. They got an export crop, building houses, living in houses. You know, it was incredible. And it was all destroyed by the Freemasons. Thank you, Freemasonry, for screwing up what could have been a model for development for the entire new world. And because the Jesuits were destroyed, we reverted to the default setting, which is slavery. And that's the cause of lots of sorrow over the next, all the way to the present day. Let's face it, we're still suffering the legacy of slavery.
Yeah, all that exploitation. And of course, we're given only two choices, which is capitalism or socialism. But what the Jesuits demonstrated in Paraguay was you could have another system that's based on development and also real concern and love for their fellow man by seeking to improve them, by applying, you know, I guess European or Western technologies and ideas and skills to actually improve their condition, to raise them to a higher level.
That's right.
Stealing their labor.
No. And the main thing they taught them was how to work.
Yeah.
Which they did not know how to do, because they were hunter-gatherers. Hunter-gatherers don't know how to work. It's feast or famine. You know, you starve to death until the porcupine shows up, and then you gorge yourself on a porcupine, and then you feel sick until you're starving again.
Yeah.
That's hunter-gatherer existence. That's the way it was in North America. It was different, but similar in Paraguay.
But the Jesuit success with the Guaranis got in the way of the carnal and temporal desires of the conquistadors, of the British, of the other colonizers who sought to conquer the area, then exploit the labor, extract the labor. Yeah,
they wanted slave labor, and that's precisely what happened when the reductions were destroyed. It was the encomienda system, which was basically slave labor. And of course, in the Caribbean, we had slavery. Mm-hmm. You know, the sugar plantations, the Dutch and the English exploiting people there, the French as well. Haiti is a classic example of what happens when you have this colonial exploitation of labor. You have people, Toussaint Louverture, I don't know whether it's true or not, but they selling his soul to the devil to get the white man out of Haiti. Well, be careful what you pray for.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's precisely what happened in Africa. You know, you want to get rid of the white man, well, be careful what you pray for. Why? Because the white man is racially superior? No. It's because, I'll give you the reason why here, okay? I met a German lady, she shows up here, and she's from Würzburg, and Würzburg has a partnership deal with the Diocese of Würzburg, Diocese of Mbinga, which is just south of Musoma, which is where I was in Tanzania. So they have a little brochure, and the brochure you open it up, and this is Diocese of Mbinga, founded in 1987, something like that. Other page, Diocese of Würzburg. Guess when Diocese of Würzburg was founded?
Probably 9th century or something?
742.
Whoa.
when the Benedictines showed up and showed my ancestors how to work. That's basically what happened. The Benedictine monastery was a workstation.
This is the basis of German labor, right? German labor?
Well, this is the beginning of German labor, which is the most sophisticated and best labor in the world.
Yes.
Even today, with all that has happened. Certainly, this is what happened. This was the cause of World War I. German labor, once they concentrated labor in the country and stopped this hemorrhaging of emigration, which is the reason I'm an American, the labor force was so productive that it surpassed England, and Lord Grey and Churchill decided to lure Germany into a war to destroy that alternative economic system.
Yes.
That's what happened. So basically, what's the difference between Mbinga and Würzburg? About 1,400 years, 1,500 years of learning how to work. So imagine, as a thought experiment, imagine if the Benedictines had pulled out of Würzburg in 772, which is pretty much what happened in Tanzania, you know?
And St. Benedict is the one that instituted the monastery reforms?
That's right.
Yeah.
And the monastery was what taught, that's what brought agriculture to my barbaric German ancestors, whose favorite activity was chasing pigs through the forest until the Benedictines arrived and taught them how to grow grapes and other things like that. And that was the beginning of the German workforce. So that's what didn't happen in Africa, and it got killed, strangled in the cradle in Paraguay. And that's pretty much the sad story of the world we live in.
And the essential point here is this isn't an accident of history. But in both cases, economic development in these areas were strangled in the grave for a specific reason, to keep it poor and easily exploitable.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because, we see that model. We saw that in Henry Kissinger when he wrote National Security Study Memorandum 200, 1974. To stifle third world development and to control the population, load
population,
it down with debt.
Well, yep.
Food as a weapon, right?
Yep. This is all part of the oligarch scheming to rule the world. And the Jews play a crucial role in this. They are always the executors, the thinkers who come up with better systems of exploitation, because they're experts at it, because they grew up with they grew rich with usury, which is the real operating system of global capitalism.
Yeah. And I think you wrote, in Bare Metal, the goal of English foreign policy during the 18th century was to promote the French equivalent of the Glorious Revolution, and to do to the Bourbons what the Whigs had done to the Stuarts. The Stuarts were the Catholic monarchs of England. This is, again, you know, when you talk about Freemasonry, you're talking about Whig intrigues.
Yes.
And you also write, this is a good, Catholicism and capitalism are mutually incompatible globalist systems, which are condemned by the very nature of their creeds to aspire to the universal hegemony and therefore be in conflict with each other. Now, this is funny because we think of capitalism in the West, and we have the Spirit of Democratic Capitalism by Michael Novak. Now, who is more wrong? Was it Michael Harrington, The Other America, or Michael Novak, The Spirit of Democratic Capitalism? Because that's socialism and capitalism. In your opinion.
Socialism is the pus that forms when the body politic comes down sick with capitalism. That's always a reaction to it.
I was recently talking about your book to somebody, and I tried to this is a crude description of your book. I thought throughout the book I see there's a dialectic being played here, and it starts the Protestant Reformation produces nationalism, which begets mercantilism. The reaction to mercantilism is laissez-faire, and the reaction to laissez-faire is socialism. Is that a fair
position? Yeah, that's it.
Okay, good.
That's it.
The attacks on the Jesuits focused on their activities in the New World, in particular on the economic system that they created to enculturate Christianity among the indigenous peoples. The Masonic attack on the church began as an attack on the Jesuits in Paraguay, largely at the hands of high-placed Masons like the Portuguese Duc de Pombal and the Duc de Chajol in France. Now, these were people, Masons installed in Catholic countries. So this is part of the Masonic infiltration you're seeing in these Catholic governments.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. It would be like a communist in the Roosevelt administration. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what it was like.
So, interesting. Very good. Now, what term would you describe? I think is it solidarism that's described this sort of this.
Yeah, that's the name that you could apply to Catholic economics. It comes from Pesch. I think that the Polish union, labor union, was based on that idea. If someone came up with a catchier phrase, it would be good. But that's the one. That's the only really word that we can use right now to describe this system.
Looking at the situation in Africa and the experience of the Tanzania and the experience of the Jesuits in the New World, particularly in Paraguay. What lessons can we take from that, and what's going on in America today?
Well, the main lesson is that labor is the source of all value. And the only alternative to labor is usury. And so that's the Jewish alternative. That Shylock says, my ducats can copulate faster than Laban's ewes and rams. That's an illusion. So if we want to move forward, we're going to have to reward labor, protect labor, and remove usury from the system as much as possible. Friedrich List was the German protectionist who came over here from Philadelphia. He said that what's more important, the apple or the apple tree? Just because you're someone down the road can sell you an apple cheaper doesn't mean that that's a good idea if he asks you to chop down your apple tree.
That's
precisely what happened in the United States. They had these Wall Street raiders who basically chopped down all the apple trees. And now we have to import apples from every place else in the world, and nobody's making any money, because the only source of wealth is the labor that goes into a product. What's the difference between a pound of flour and a pound of bread? Well, bread's more valuable than flour. What's the difference? It's labor. It's really the only difference. Obviously, water goes into bread, but that's insignificant. The only difference is human labor, and that is the source of what we call surplus value, and surplus value is the source of wealth. It's the only real source of wealth. And so you have to protect labor if you want to have prosperity. And that's, we did the exact opposite by loading all of these productive enterprises in the Midwest, Midwest manufacturing, loading them down with debt, outsourcing, sending the factories to Mexico. And we're poor now because we did that. The middle of the country is poor. They woke up and realized this, and that's why they voted for Donald Trump.
You made a point in the article about Nyerere that he talked about how the Catholic nations were the most oppressive. And, of course, you said, well, all those Catholic nations that he cited were victims of Masonic revolutions instituted by the CIA and in MI6.
Yeah, that was, I mean, if there's the worst Nyerere is the Nyerere who's strutting around in front of the Maronal nuns in 1970 in Ossining, New York. He was chastised later on. The later Nyerere is much sadder but wiser.
Yeah.
And what I just heard that the Congregation of Saints in Rome, Nyerere has been proposed for canonization. So that will be interesting that the guy who supported Che Guevara in the Congo is now being proposed for canonization in the Catholic Church.
But now,
what I learned is that they only consider the last 10 years of your life. So if that's the case, then there's hope for Nyerere, I think.
You write a lot about Adam Smith, of course, in this book. And Adam Smith recognized the value of labor, but he wasn't willing to go after usury because that would upset his benefactors, correct?
That's right. The Whig oligarchs who – he was a made man. Mm. He was like the beginning of the things like the Rhodes Scholarship. The Whig oligarchs were looking for bright young people who would promote their ideas, and Adam Smith was one. David Hume. They also happened to be orphans. They tend to pick orphans, people that don't have fathers, so they could become the kind of surrogate father.
Yeah.
And that's what Harvard, Yale, and Oxford and Cambridge are there to do, create administrators for the global empire.
And, the Rhodes Scholarship.
Rhodes Scholarship is an institutionalization of that.
Yeah, you internalize the commands of your oppressors, and it makes imperialism all that easier. The conquest all that easier because
you're the administrator, so in a sense, you're one of the oppressors yourself. That's what our gay mayor is. He's a Rhodes Scholar. He went to Harvard. You know, he's administering the empire. He's trying to get out of town. He's damaged goods now, unfortunately. I think that the choice of the Democratic National Committee, they didn't go for a homosexual. He was in the running and he didn't make it. The guy they chose is basically an ethnic, he's Mexican with, he's Hispanic. I don't know whether he's Mexican or not, but he's got labor background. So they're going back to their roots. I think the whole homosexual thing has passed. I think everybody's sick to death of homosexual propaganda. Apparently that TV series at ABC
The Rising or something.
When We Rise.
Yeah, jeez.
Flop. They, as Sam Goldwyn would say, they stayed away in droves.
Now, of course, we were talking about Adam Smith, and you do have this one paragraph. I'll read it. At the very moment when Europe, under England's intellectual lead, was about to subject the world to an economic system based on the systematic theft of labor, the Jesuits came up with a Catholic alternative to capitalism, not only in theory but in practice. If the Paraguay reductions had been allowed to survive, the Jesuits might have written their own version of The Wealth of Nations before Adam Smith wrote his. As it was, the world had to wait another century and a half before the Jesuits, in the person of Heinrich Petsch, drew the full theoretical implications of their labors in the New World. Yeah, so that's a story that you don't hear about the Jesuits.
No, who's Heinrich Petsch?
Yeah.
I have enough trouble with Friedrich List. You mention Friedrich List to an economist, he thinks, isn't that a Hungarian pianist? I'm serious. A man I respect who is an economist at the university in Australia never heard of Friedrich List.
Well, the reason why people like Adam Smith are promoted and other economists aren't.
Right.
The reason why, look at Paul Krugman, right?
Yeah, look at Paul Krugman, the guy who goes to Iceland and says, yeah, pay off your debt. See you, Paul. See you. Here's your ticket. Go back to to Wall Street. We know who you work for now. So. Fortunately, the Icelandic people didn't listen to what Paul Krugman said.
That's right. You know, and
nice guy, bright guy. I mean, he won a Nobel Prize. Got to have some. But he's a stooge of the Wall Street people.
Yeah.
So what good does it do if you're smart? If all you're going to do is, be a stooge, it's no good.
Well, if you went on, if you went on Face the Nation or one of the talk shows, these chatting class shows, and you talked about usury and institutionalized capitalism being institutionalized usury, and you mentioned the Jewish element to it. You're not going to get too far in your career.
Do you think that's why I haven't been on Meet the Press?
I think that might be a good reason. Yeah, that's
why. That's why I haven't been invited to talk on Meet the Press.
Yes. So, you got to say the right things, right? You got to say the right things, and I guess find out who rules over you. Of course, Voltaire said that, right? Find out who you're not allowed to criticize.
Yeah. Yep.
The Whig agent. Said that. So, well, great. Listen, I want to thank you, Dr. Jones, for coming back on the show. Of course, right now, your current book is Barren Metal, A History of Capitalism as a Conflict Between Labor and Usury. I am reading it. I am what page am I on now here? Yeah, 777, actually.
Oh, you're halfway through.
Yes, it's a wonderful read. I wish I didn't have to have a job.
Can you?
But it is. I mean, it's a huge book, but listen, you shouldn't let that intimidate you because it really is a wonderful read. I was really moved by the story of the Jesuits and the reductions because it's something that I just wasn't aware of. And, surprise, surprise, I wasn't taught about that in university. And your new book is on development economics?
The Pump, Kamuge, Julius Nyerere, and the Collapse of Development Economics. So it's really kind of spins off right from Barren Metal. The principles of Barren Metal just got applied in a slightly different situation, development economics in Africa. And it's basically a history of the 70s and the whole change that in the world that took place with Reagan and Thatcher, and we're still living under that curse today. So, yeah, it was a really great experience. So I'm hoping to get some type of reaction.
Yeah, Barren Metal, then the Jewish revolutionary spirit, Slaughter of Cities, Libido Dominandi. Am I missing one?
Yeah, I've got a bunch of other ones, but
I mean, these primary books.
It's too long a list to go into.
And so when do you expect this to be out, your latest work?
It will be, the announcement's going to go out in April.
That's soon.
So
excellent.
Copies will be available. So go to culturewars.com you can order your copy.
Okay, that's good. Yeah, I know. My next book on my list is Wim Hof's book. I'm going to buy that as soon as I finish Barren Metal.
Yes.
But of course, that plays a part here too. Of course, because you talked about Vatican II and the intrigues of Vatican II, and what happened to the Catholic Church, and he writes about that. That's the
John Courtney's role in that, a very important role in working with the CIA to change the Church's teaching on church-state relations. Mm-hmm.
Did you ever hear about the intrigue about Look magazine?
Look magazine told the story of Malachi Martin.
Then it was shut down the next year. I think it folded the next year.
Yeah, well, maybe it wasn't a coincidence then.
So I didn't know about that. I heard Look magazine did about the then they alluded to it, didn't name names. Then an article in Spotlight actually identified Malachi Martin as the agent. And then subsequently, him with the B'nai B'rith and I guess this publishing deal that he got and all that. So, but that's all part of the story here about the infiltration of the church in the 60s. And
that's in the Jewish revolutionary spirit. The whole chapter, whole story of Malachi Martin trying to subvert Vatican II.
Mm-hmm. So, well, listen, I'll let you go now. I want to thank you for spending so much time with me this evening.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And I'll let you go. And again, that is Dr. E. Michael Jones, the editor of Culture Wars magazine, culturewars.com, prolific writer, author. I highly recommend his books. There's nothing else out there like it. And it really will it gives you a deep understanding of some of these events, a perspective that you will not get anywhere else. And it really changes your outlook on these things. So great. Well, thank you. And thank I'll let you. You go, and good night, and we'll maybe come, maybe the springtime, we'll talk again.
Sure.
Great, and maybe I'll be finished with your book by then. Good night.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Good night.